Short and sweet. That's what we've done with this episode of the Vermont Edition podcast. I'm Matthew Smith, producer of Vermont Edition, and I wanted to say thanks for listening, and we hope you enjoy.
This is Vermont Edition. I'm Bob Kinzel. When the 2019 legislative session ended, many Progressive Party leaders were disappointed that the Democratic majorities in both the House and the Senate were unable to pass legislation that provided paid family leave, increased the state minimum wage, or dealt significantly with climate change. Josh Ronsky is the executive director of the Vermont Progressive Party. This is how he summed up his feelings about the failure of the Democrats to address these and other issues.
Just because you have a D next to your name doesn't mean that you're necessarily a progressive Democrat, and it doesn't mean you're even necessarily supportive of things like minimum wage increases, paid family leave, climate change. And if there are a number of Democrats that are essentially voting with the Republican Party consistently, I don't really see them as even Democrats, really.
Well, what are some of the progressive priorities for the 2020 session? We're going to talk to Lieutenant Governor David Zuckerman about these issues today. Lieutenant Governor Zuckerman is the highest-ranking third-party state official in the country. He also ran as a Democrat in his last two statewide elections. David Zuckerman, welcome back to Vermont Edition.
Well, it's good to be here, and thankfully the roads had started to clear up by the time I had to get down to Montpelier.
Just to start off with the end of the session and dealing with the Democratic inability to pass raising the minimum wage and paid family leave, you told me at that time that you were very disappointed that those issues didn't get advanced. As you look forward to the 2020 session, do you think the outlook is any better for those issues?
Oh, definitely. I think so. I think Vermonters clearly supported those kinds of legislative priorities going into the session. I know the House and Senate both worked hard to pass versions of each of those bills. It was a matter of coming to consensus that ended up being the sticking point near the end, and they got quite close. And I know that the leadership of the House and leadership of the Senate are talking to each other and figuring out how to move forward with those pieces of legislation that are frankly very important to a lot of struggling Vermonters.
So as you look at some of the top priorities for the Progressive Party coming up for the 2020 session, would you put paid family leave and raising the state minimum wage near the top of the list?
Well, I think they're both important. Raising minimum wage, I think, is the most fundamental with respect to sort of wage and economic circumstances. It's so clear, you know, 80,000 Vermonters would be impacted by raises of 50 to 75 cents per year and per hour per year. When you multiply that out, it's important for people to recognize a 50 cent per hour raise for a full-time minimum wage worker is $1,000 a year. $1,000 a year for someone who's really struggling to meet their bills, you know, it's over $100 a month. That goes a long way. But I think housing are big priorities, healthcare reform, continuing to move in some way towards a less complicated, less bureaucratic, less insurance profit method of healthcare is still high on the minds of not just progressives, but voters across the whole state. Citizens, frankly, and looking at whether it's primary universal health care or some method of moving the dial a little faster on some of those big ticket items are all important to progressive Democratic thinkers. When you look at the platforms of the Progressive and the Democratic Party, they're actually very, very similar. And I think most of the voters of the state agree with those platforms. And then ultimately, the big issue that is going to long-term be an economic issue, short-term is just talking about our children's future, our own future with respect to climate crisis. And folks talk to me about that all over the state, from last year's drought to this spring's sporadic, really cold, wet weather that set a lot of farmers behind. And then, of course, we just had this Halloween storm, not obviously the scale of Tropical Storm Irene, but you know, these are coming more frequently, more severely. They have economic consequences. We're talking $5 to $10 million in damages to our roads and bridges, and interrupting commerce capacity and people's ability to get to work safely. People's homes have been destroyed or flooded out in their basements. You know, the climate crisis is real, and they want us to do more than sort of small measures. And they're not only looking to the legislature for that. The governor, when he first came into office, signed a quite significant climate action commission, you know, 50-odd recommendations. And, you know, the leadership from the governor's office has been quite thin with respect to tackling climate crisis. You know, he's very good at making statements like, we will adopt the Paris Climate Accord. Well, those are good words. But where's the action to really get behind that, to implement the policies we need to do to reduce our carbon emissions? We're going up right now, not down. It's the wrong direction.
So what do you specifically want to see lawmakers do? I know there are a lot of people who are raising climate change as the most important issue that the state of Vermont needs to deal with in the coming years. But I don't hear a lot of specifics about what should be done. So when you fault the governor for not taking action, if you were governor, what would you do?
Well, I'd be looking at a number of things. Primarily, you know, increasing weatherization funding by $1 or $2 million or $3 million is not going to crack the nut on really reducing household energy consumption, which is one of the largest arenas. I know one of his commission's reports was to really increase, you know, heat pumps and some other far more efficient heating systems in houses. Yes, these things take money. Well, then maybe we need to talk about revenue generation to pay for these things. They also create jobs, lots of jobs, HVAC jobs, construction jobs, weatherization jobs. Those are real jobs that pay people decent wages. I would look at those. I would look at transportation. There's been an increase in the subsidies for electric vehicles. I don't think there are enough of those subsidies yet to get us on the path towards 50, 60, 70,000 electric vehicles across this state by 2025. If you increase it by 1,000 a year, you're not going to get there. And really reducing our dependence on fossil fuel, one of those, that is another one that returns money into the Vermont economy. As people use electric vehicles and stop spending money on fossil fuel vehicles and then the fossil fuel to run them, they will have more money in their pocket to spend at the local grocery store, to put a deck on the back of their house, to do those supposedly trickle-down things that were supposed to happen from Reaganomics when millionaires got yet more money. When working-class people have more money in their pocket, they spend it locally. So these things are going to churn the economy, not just cost the state money.
So there may be a lot of people who would agree with you. Let's put more money into weatherization. Let's put more money into electric vehicle subsidies and other programs. The catch is, how are
Where's
you going to pay?
Where
does the money come from? Are we inevitably talking about a carbon tax?
Not necessarily. In fact, there's a lot of different ways to generate revenue in the state. Some are more regressive and some are more progressive. But fundamentally, the most progressive is based on income. When you do a carbon tax, ultimately, and I said this in my last campaign, and it's why it diffused the attacks on me around a carbon tax, if you do it based on carbon and fuel, and you then return, as one would need to do to make it non-regressive, you return a bunch of that revenue to long-distance drivers to work, low-income Vermonters, then you actually end up with very little money left over to implement the actual policy you want to implement. So you really have to look towards those that have the resources. And granted, Vermont does not have as many super wealthy people as a Massachusetts or a New Hampshire, but there are folks who are doing quite well. Many of them have said, I would be willing to pay more in taxes. Most of those that are wealthy and tend to say, I don't want to pay anymore. This is mine. I'm going to hoard my money. Many of them have moved. Others are still here. And I would ask them, what's more important, having a lot of money in a bank account when you pass away or putting that money into the efforts to make a planet and a community that's livable for your children and grandchildren? So I would go out and ask those folks who are really opposed, who do have higher wealth, and say, where are your priorities? Can't we put this money to better use, investing in Vermont jobs and investing in Vermont's future for our children? That's where I would go.
So you would look at something like an income tax surcharge
Either,
on wealthy people?
Absolutely. It might be temporary. Depends on what the numbers work out to be. You know, I don't have the staff that the governor has to crunch every single one of these numbers and find out how much money could be raised by this rate or that rate. But I would look to that direction before I looked towards hitting working class people with more taxes.
You mentioned health care, and there was a bill in the legislature that would provide primary care for all Vermonters and then Vermonters would still get an insurance policy to pay for those services above and beyond that. Is it realistic to believe that that's going to receive much attention in the 2020 session?
I think that's probably unlikely. I think a lot of the momentum is in the One Care model and looking at little tweaks and pieces around the edge. I know they were looking at pharmaceutical prescription drug pricing, and I think they could continue to work on that. It isn't until you encounter the system that you realize how broken it really is. I've had two different circumstances this summer and fall that have just blown me away. The first was an employee of mine who cut his finger. He went to urgent care. They told him, oh, it's $150 for the stitches and then to get them out. And I got a bill for almost $1,000 as a worker comp claim. And I said, you know, what happened? You know, you said my employee had told me what they said. He said, that's what they told me. I don't know. And the business said, well, no, that's only if you paid on the spot. And if you don't pay on the spot, then it goes up. And once we file for workers' comp, it also goes up. And I sit there and go, wait a minute. Let's look at this towards addressing the workers' comp system. Is it getting bilked for money? Are businesses paying more than they should be? Because that's how some of these urgent care and other places are taking advantage of it. Let's look into that. The other was that very frustratingly, my wife and daughter and I were out hiking some spare time that is kind of rare in my life. And she tripped and broke her hip. And the MRI at Porter was 40% less than it would have cost at UVM Medical Center. Now, UVM Medical Center certainly has more overhead costs. They're a tertiary care facility. They provide services that nobody else provides, and they do have to blend that cost over other services that they provide. But that seems like a very big delta, a big difference. Why are those costs so high? So I think there's a lot of ways to look at the healthcare system and dig in a little bit and say, what's really going on here?
How is she doing?
Well, it's a 6 to 12 month healing process. You can't get a cast for your hip because you can't move and you can't do your bodily functions. So you're on crutches and, you know, we're farmers. And so she pushes through and occasionally maybe puts a little too much weight on it and doesn't heal quite as fast. But she's moving in the right direction. And it's just a long, slow, frustrating process.
I want to talk to you about corrections reform, because that's something that your office and you have made a priority during your tenure as lieutenant governor. It was interesting this week, the state of Oklahoma initiated the largest commutation of prison sentences that's ever happened in the United States. And they decided in Oklahoma that if you're in jail because of simple drug possession charges or low-level property crimes or non-violent crimes, that all those crimes should be reclassified as misdemeanors, and all you have to do is apply to the state and say, well, now my crime is a misdemeanor, I get to get out of jail. Some 400 or 500 people were released from jail in Oklahoma earlier this week. The thought is it may be as many as 3,000 people before the program is over in 6 months. I should mention that Oklahoma has the highest incarceration rate in population of any state in the country. Mm. So they were really looking at a budget issue and whether or not they wanted to build another prison in Oklahoma. What are your thoughts about that approach and ways to reduce Vermont's prison population?
Well, first, I have to say that's an amazing piece of news, and I think it's a real admission that the war on drugs and the idea of just locking everybody up for anything that they do wrong in society is obviously a clear failure. It costs us tremendous amounts of dollars to keep people incarcerated. It doesn't help them become better citizens when they get out. It's really the whole system has some pretty significant flaws. I also want to give a shout out to House leaders in the past and Senate leaders, whether it was Bill Lippert, Maxine Grad, Dick Sears, who have done a lot of work with their committees to adjust our laws over time. Back in 2007, we passed a law to really look at incarceration rates and change some of our penalties. And we've seen a 30% reduction in our prison population since 2007. So there's been good progress in Vermont that was done thoughtfully, you know, starting 12 years ago. And I know that they now have passed a bill and there's a committee looking into what are the next steps that we can do to continue in that direction. So once again, you know, some people say Vermont has to stop being a leader. You know, Vermont's been doing this and we're being a leader and we're continuing to do that. There's certainly more to do. And I think we have to look to criminal justice reform experts. Attorney General T.J. Donovan has done a lot of work in that regard, both when he was state's attorney in Chittenden County, as well as now as Attorney General, looking at possibilities on some of the smaller things, the fines that sometimes you get a ticket and you can't pay the ticket because you're living paycheck to paycheck, and then the ticket doubles and triples, and then you get a second ticket, and then it's a heavier violation because the first ticket wasn't paid. And working to say, wait a minute, having poverty, being in poverty, is not what should end up landing you in jail. So we've had some great leadership on that around the state, and I know they're working towards more system changes so that we don't keep putting people in prison for reasons they shouldn't be.
Let's go to our callers and start off with Tom, who's calling from Royalton. Hey, Tom, welcome to the program.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. Often, Mr. Zimmerman, when you talk about your progressive goals, you talk about taxing the wealthy and talk about people with great wealth, and then go right to an income tax. And often those income taxes actually hurt the working class who may have high incomes and don't have massive wealth. Many people in the state of Vermont don't work a lot, but may have, you know, higher wealth. And I wonder what percentage of the legislature derive their income from passive wealth instruments as opposed to actually laboring, and how the legislature themselves benefit from the taxes, tax bills they pass, whether it's income sensitivity for their primary home, current use, or the proposed healthcare plan you had under Shumlin, where it was going to be a payroll tax and it wouldn't hit people's passive wealth instruments. And then I wanted to make a point about healthcare afterwards, if that's okay.
Well, Tom, let's see if we can address your first question with the lieutenant governor. You know, it's an interesting issue that Tom raises that's come up in the presidential race as well, in terms of some candidates talking about a wealth tax. And as Tom points out, there are people who have great financial resources, but perhaps their incomes aren't all that large. And then you have a lot of people, or a number of people, with higher incomes, but not necessarily a lot of financial resources. Do you think that the lawmakers ought to take a look at something like a wealth tax?
Well, I think Tom makes a very good point. It's fair. And I certainly, in my mindset and value set, actually fully agree with you. So I was probably either too short spoken, which is not a typical complaint about me, with respect to defining some of these things. So I agree with you entirely. The legislature a number of years ago looked at income sensitivity and tried to look at some of that passive income and whether or not passive income would be valued at double or triple what it was valued with respect to whether one qualified for income sensitivity, so that someone who maybe had, you know, $2 million in liquid assets down in, you know, Wall Street, making $60,000 a year, should they be getting an income sensitivity payment instead of saying, okay, well, that's actually, for income sensitivity purposes, the equivalent of $180,000. So they don't need a $1,000 or $2,000 tax break on their education spending. I supported that change. It didn't go through. I don't recall why the legislature didn't do it, but I would certainly be open to revisiting that sort of look at things like income sensitivity. With respect to straight up taxing wealth, I know that those ideas are proposed. I would not be opposed to them, except I think there's some constitutional questions that are also being looked at, whether or not you can do that. But that would be another arena to look at. So I'm not averse to looking at wealth as part of the rubric of those that have resources, whether it's high annual incomes or high wealth outside of their income, to say, what is the future you want? Is it a future where we have a climate that our kids and grandkids can live? Do we and can we invest in these weatherization, electric vehicles, heat pumps, and so forth, to do our part towards moving our planet in a healthier direction for the future? I'm totally open to that.
Let's turn to Christopher, who's calling from Johnson. Hey, Christopher, welcome to the program.
Hi, thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I'm a 29-year-old business owner. I'll keep this short. I own a company called 45th Parallel Hemp out of Johnson, Vermont. And I'm interested in hearing from the Lieutenant Governor, and also as a fellow hemp farmer, about what he thinks the effect on the hemp program in Vermont is going to be based on the new FDA rules, the proposed rules that are in the comment period right now. I'll take my question off the air. Thank you.
Okay, Christopher, thanks very much. And as Christopher mentioned, you are also a hemp farmer in addition to many vegetables and other things that you grow.
Vegetables, pigs, chickens, yep.
Yep.
I'm not as big a hemp farmer as some. I dabbled in it with 500 plants, which is a little under or about a little over half an acre, because I was concerned at the potential overproduction, at some of the, you know, drying constraints and some of the processing constraints. So I'm not quite as big as some of those fields Vermonters are seeing all over the state. But what the gentleman is calling in about, Chris was calling in about, is that the federal rulemaking process under the USDA Farm Bill is putting much tighter restrictions on the levels of total THC that can be in the plant versus THC Delta 9, which is a subset of the THC category, and that is the one that has the psychoactive properties that some people are concerned about. And Vermont's law or Vermont's rule allows for up to 1% on that total THC and 0.3% on the THC Delta 9. Sorry to give so many details. I just want to give some of your listeners the parameters of what he was calling about. I know the Vermont Agency of Agriculture has indicated opposition to those federal rules. There's all kinds of discussion groups online across the country working against those rules. Most of the CBD strains of the cannabis plant have well below the THC Delta 9 number, but have a hard time staying below total THC of 0.3 while having any real amount of CBD, which is what is used for the tinctures and the salves for folks that have been using that. And I think it would be a devastating impact on the hemp industry for a good 2 to 3 years until genetics and breeding could come up with varieties that could somehow meet those constraints. But I know folks are writing into the federal government comment, and certainly anybody in Vermont who cares about this issue and this, excuse the pun, but budding new industry should call in or write in their comments to try to push back on these new federal rules.
Let's talk to Joni, who's calling from Lindenville. Hi, Joni. Welcome to the program.
Hi there. Hi there. Thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
Hello, can you hear me?
Yeah.
Yes, we can.
Oh, okay, great. So my comment is about the cold climate heat pumps and some of the subsidies that Efficiency Vermont are providing. You know, we're sort of a lower middle class couple, and we were, you know, I think we find ourselves in the same position as a lot of Vermonters. We're too rich to qualify for any of the assistance, and but not really wealthy enough to pay for some of the things like this that come up. We had to replace our furnace recently, and of course we would love to go with a heat pump and or you know other ways of buttoning up our double wide manufactured home. But none of the things that are out there really seem to be geared towards low-income Vermonters. You know, like all the Efficiency Vermont subsidies were like, you know, if you have an attic or a basement or you're buying a $20,000, pellet boiler or, you know, things like that. And I just, I think that a lot of people find themselves stuck, you know, when they want to do the right thing for the environment, but yet, you know, just can't afford to.
Okay. Joni, you know, Lieutenant Governor Zuckerman, I've heard this comment that Joni just made from a lot of folks who feel that some of the energy efficiency programs that you were talking about, be it weatherization, providing subsidies for electric cars, that it's going to be the more upper middle class people in Vermont who take advantage of those programs who probably could already pay for them.
Well, I think you're both absolutely right. There's sort of a sandwich here where if you're wealthy enough to take advantage of things like tax credits, then it helps wealthier people incentivize to do something they could either already afford to do or close enough to already afford to do that it makes it worth it. And then a lot of the support programs for lower income people support very low income and hadn't historically helped sort of that middle area that I think Joni is describing herself as. And frankly, that's probably the majority of Vermonters who are right in there. Hard working class people, they're paying their bills, they're making their way. But to come up with that extra couple thousand dollars is a big price to pay, and there's not quite enough support out there. I believe the legislature expanded some of those qualifying ranges in the last legislature to try to meet the circumstances that Joni is talking about, although I can't promise that. But I do think they're looking at that to say, okay, how do we make this more available to that next layer that's above the really, really poor? So, Joni, I think you're raising a really good point, and it's something that we should continue to look at and try to continue to expand. Part of it is, where do the resources come from, which, again, we already talked about earlier, and where's the most effective place to put them? In some respects, I think putting them into that moderate to low-income window may be a really great place to go, because it might cost a little bit less per house, because the house can afford to cover a little more of it, and it would incent far more to do so. But that's off the cuff. I would need to look at the statistics on that deeper. But she makes a great point.
Joni, thanks for your phone call. I wanted to talk to you about the 2020 election. You've said that you're reviewing your possible options for next year. You might seek re-election as lieutenant governor. You might even consider running for governor. What factors are you considering as you contemplate your political future?
Well, there's a lot to talk about here, but primarily, when I sort of look at my hand and start at one being the thumb and five being the pinky, family, my business, the farm, could it survive without my efforts? My spouse does a tremendous amount of work there already, but to put more on her shoulders while she's struggling with Lyme disease and, of course, now this broken hip is a big, big factor. Do people think I could do a good job? Do I think I could do the job well? And then ultimately at the bottom is, frankly, what's my chances of winning? Because if I were to run in and lose even by 2 to 3 points, I would consider that a victory, because I think it would really change the legislative and governor dynamic, where right now people think, oh, well, the governor is really broadly supported. He wins by 14%. So that really, you know, hobbles the legislature from being as aggressive as maybe I would like to see it be. And I think a lot of Vermonters would like to see it be on some of these issues. So the meme is out there that, well, they better go a little slow. And if TJ runs or I run or Rebecca Holcomb runs as she is and does better than the 14% losses of the past, I think that really changes the dynamic and really would expose the governor for doing good things when it's presented to him as a reaction to the moment. I think it's great that he signed that gun legislation, but that sort of came around because of the threat that was put in front of him. It wasn't something he planned for and had vision to do. He's been really great at talking about backfilling the Title X funding that's being cut at the federal level for women's reproductive health. But where is his leadership on raising minimum wage, which would actually put more money in women's pockets so they would have greater access to health care regardless of government spending? You know, Paris, you know, he's talked a good game about climate change and the climate crisis, but where has his real leadership been? He's got this committee that came out with 50-odd recommendations for things to do about climate crisis, and he's barely led and implemented a fraction of those ideas that are now over a year old. So I think anybody running should be taking him on those things and giving the legislature more room to do the work that Vermonters want to see done.
So just listening to you now, I'm getting the impression that you're kind of leaning against running for governor.
I wake up every day with a different thought in my head. You know, some days I eat breakfast with my family and I think, you know, can I personally and emotionally afford not to see my family for the next 10, 12 months? And the next day I might wake up and go, you know, in my head, I think the numbers work. It might work. The state needs someone to run who's got these issues well known and can go out there and really fight for them and change the discourse and move the dial on these issues. And as I look at my daughter, think about her future and go, I have to run. So it's a real torment internally, and it's something I've got to figure out.
So what do you think is going to be the deciding factor?
Boy, I don't know. I think my family is probably going to be the biggest deciding factor, just really continuing to talk with them about what the possibilities are and how we would manage it as a family. Listening to Vermonters, and if they are, you know, reaching out saying, you know, we really would like to see you run, you know, I would talk to my family about that as well. I've got a great crew on the farm that if they are ready to run with it a little bit next year with less of my leadership, and I do think they're pretty capable of doing that, that's a possibility. There's a lot of weighing considerations. And, you know, I really would like to see what's going to happen in this next session. Is the governor going to step up on climate change? Is he going to step up and lead the way getting people's paychecks bigger? He talks a lot about affordability, and yet it's really clear that costs are one side of the equation. And Vermont is a little bit more expensive than other places. But as much as we think it's a lot more expensive, statistics don't show that. But our incomes are 18% below the national average. He's got to get behind raising the minimum wage significantly, put more money into the local economy. He's got to get behind real climate change action possibilities and really help the legislature lead the way on some of these changes. There's a lot of factors that will impact it.
Wanted to touch just before we end with Bernie Sanders' presidential campaign. You've been a surrogate for him over in New Hampshire a couple of times. You know, it seems like when you hear from political analysts that it's going to be important for whoever the Democratic nominee is that they win back some of the moderate votes that went to President Trump in the Midwestern states in particular. Do you think Bernie Sanders is the person to do that?
Well, I think the overall meme is about 100,000 times wrong. The historical way that things are looked at is how do you persuade the 2% in the quote middle, which makes you think voters are on this one straight line, which anybody who talks to friends knows that people are all over the place. That 2% in the middle, we can persuade one way or the other. The last election, 60-odd million people voted for Trump, 66-odd million voted for Hillary Clinton, and 90 million people did not vote. If the Democratic Party, and I support Bernie, make that clear, but and the voters in the Democratic primaries put up someone who excites 5 or 10 million more people, then persuading 1 million in the middle to toggle back or forth would be swamped. You bring out 6, 10 million more people in those, quote, purple or swing states. You know, if 500,000 more people or 200,000 more people voted in Pennsylvania and they were 8-2 for the Democrat, that 10,000 vote margin wouldn't have mattered. So I disagree with the meme that it's a battle for the middle. I think it's a battle for struggling people who are passionate about issues that have not been addressed by government, whether it's criminal justice reform, climate change, economic injustice, gender inequality. Those are the things that are going to bring people out, and Trump will lose.
And that seems to be the strategy that the Sanders campaign has taken on, just what you're describing in terms of having, you know, millions of small donors and really trying to put together the strongest grassroots campaign that the country has ever seen.
And getting young people to vote. And you look at the numbers, Bernie's campaign and some of the other more exciting candidates are getting young people interested. This is the first election that young people are the biggest plurality over boomers. If young people voted at 60-70% like everybody else may in the presidential race, game over for the next 30 years.
It's a fascinating discussion today about politics in Vermont. Lieutenant Governor David Zuckerman, many thanks for taking the time to be on the program today.
It's always a pleasure. Thank you, Bob.